parenting is not for the faint of heart. Among all the promise and the heartache and the love is the challenge of showing your children the reality of the world without souring their faith in the future. Today's guest channels this inherent contradiction in her poems. She's Maggie Smith, this week on Story in the Public Square. And welcome to A Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Selva Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. To do that, we sit down every week with the best storytellers around, filmmakers, authors, journalists, and more, to make sense of the big stories that shape public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Maggie Smith, an award-winning poet whose most recent collection, Good Bones, was published to critical acclaim. Maggie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You are the first pure poet we've had on the show. We've had other guests who have dabbled in poetry, but you're the first real poet that we've had. So thank you so much for
joining us. It's an honor, and we've had over 100 guests, so this is truly an honor for us.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about your background. How did you come to write poetry? Was this something that sort of started in childhood and stuck, or how did you get into this?
Yeah, I mean, I started writing poems as a teenager, and I think that's when most poets begin writing, that sort of critical adolescent malaise that we all have, where we feel like we have so many feelings and don't know how to express them. And so I began writing, I don't know, 13, 14, and wrote all through high school. I used to keep a manila folder in my locker that I kept my handwritten poems in, and I would tell trusted friends the combination, and they could come and sort of check out the poems, like a library, and put little comments on them, and that was the sort of level of comfort I felt at the time with sharing the poems, and then in college started writing more and publishing.
They're at that stage, I think they're almost little capsules of truth, that but things that we're maybe not willing to say out loud, but we'll put it on paper.
Yeah, they're still like that.
Yeah.
Aren't they? I mean, I still feel like I will say things in a poem that I might not say across a table. And it's a way of sort of practicing that bravery and vulnerability, and eventually I have to share it.
Well, so at what point, though, does sort of like the musings of a teenager sort of lost in their angst transform to someone who's, you become conscious of form and the structures of poems? When does that develop in your case?
I mean, I think it's different for everybody. For me, I think my poems started sounding like me in college. And I think when we all start out, whether you're painting or writing or playing music, we all start out as sort of cover artists, right? So like your first guitar song's probably gonna be
Stairway to Heaven.
Well, maybe. I was gonna go with the Beatles.
Speak for yourself, okay? Speak for yourself on that.
I was gonna go with the Beatles, maybe The Who, maybe, I don't know. The first photography you do, the first painting you paint, the first poem you write. I mean, I think I wrote Sylvia Plath cover poems for most of high school, and it took me a while of reading widely and sort of learning my own style away from my favorite poets to start feeling like I had my own voice and my own style, and that happened in college, in my early 20s, I'd say.
So you mentioned some other forms of storytelling, creative enterprises. What about poetry, as opposed to, you could have written scripts, you could have been a cover band and been a musician, you could have done novels, you could have done short stories, but you get into poetry, it sounds like, early in your writing career.
Yeah.
What was it about a poem, as opposed to all these other forms of expression and storytelling?
Well, if you'd read my short stories, it would be very clear to you why I'm not a short story writer.
You know, and it would be, in my case, you could see why I became a journalist.
Yeah, people ask that, like, why poetry? And I mean, my answers are often jokey, which is I don't have a plot bone in my body, which is true. I don't. The idea of having to make people up and give them things to say and get them from a location A to a location B, I don't have any idea how to do that. I find it magical. The idea of performing in front of people as a musician terrifies me. So poetry was, especially for an introverted kid, a place where I could just really sort of focus and especially with description. Like, I think poetry more than any other genre is a place you go to sort of see things in a new way. And that's what I found in poems as I was reading them. And then that's what I wanted to sort of recreate when I was writing them, is how can I say something here that will make, that sort of move the furniture in someone else's brain in such a way that it can't quite go back in the same old carpet grooves again, so that the next time they see this kind of tree or they have this kind of experience, maybe they'll be seeing it through the lens of this poem, and this will be something they carry with them, because that's what poems have done for me more than stories or you know, nonfiction or even music or film. I mean, poems are the things that sort of give me my frame of reference.
So today, where do you find inspiration for your poems? I mean, they cover a lot of topics. We're going to get into a few of them in a moment. But just in general, I mean, maybe even walk us through a day or a week when ideas are percolating and you're writing or maybe not writing, just thinking.
Yeah.
Where does
it
come from?
Especially with Good Bones, now it's a lot of it's my kids. And not in that way, like, everything they say is so cute. I mean, a lot of it is, a lot of it's not.
That's Instagram, by the way.
Yeah, that's not poetry. But there's something about, I still live in my hometown, which I think is important. And so I'm in the same environment all the time. I've lived there my whole life. I was born in the same hospital that my kids were born in, that my mother was born in, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I see the same trees, the same clouds, the same, I hear the same birds, I see the same people all the time. And so part of what's helped me to keep my environment fresh enough to write about it is introducing new people to that same old place. And if you cannot take a walk with kids without them saying, "Mom, look, look." And it might just be a caterpillar or the knot on a tree or the way the wind sounds through this particular branch or anything. But it's something about parenting is requiring me to pay closer attention.
So does that open your eyes to a fresher look at familiar things, A? And B, do you channel or do you sort of go back to your own childhood when you had those fresh, innocent eyes and didn't need to actually think about it, it just happened?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and part of writing this book was I felt sort of like a hinge between my parents and my children. So I'm the daughter of a mother, but I'm also the mother of a daughter. And so part of parenting a child who, I mean, my daughter's now 10, I remember being 10. I started writing poems not long after I was her age. So I'm seeing her, and in some strange way, it is sort of like a palimpsest, right? Like I'm seeing also myself. I mean, my daughter plays in the backyard where I grew up.
Wow.
And so we're having a lot of the same life experiences, and it's like poetry gold, honestly.
Do you think that the experience of being a parent has made you a better observer of these things? Or do you think that it's just sort of forced you to look at the world through children's eyes again?
You know, I think it has. I think parenting has made me more observant. But I also think in some ways being a poet has made me a better parent in that regard, because I'm already someone who's sort of tuned in to those little nuances.
Is it a kind of empathy?
I think it is. I mean, I've called poetry empathy machines before, which, you know, there are little machines made of words. I think of them as sort of empathy machines because they are humanizing objects. And I think, you know, we have to be honest about what poems can and can't do. You know, a lot of times I think, like, what can poems do? Why, there's so much in the world that I would love to fix. Why am I here writing a poem? What can this poem do? It's not going to feed someone who's really hungry. It's not water if you're thirsty. It's not a tourniquet if you're bleeding. Poems can't do those things, but I do think they feed our spirits in a way and sort of provide a connection between people that is really meaningful.
Wow. We want you to do a reading.
Okay.
We'd actually like you to do a lot of readings, but we need to discuss things. So let's have you read one of the selections from Good Bones called Sky.
I'll read Sky. So I should say there's a series of poems in this book that I call nonnets, which is sort of not quite a sonnet. They're 14-line poems, and they were all inspired by questions that my daughter asked me in the car when she was 3 and 4 years old. So these existential questions that children ask you when they've got you, and the doors lock, and you're on your way to the pharmacy, and they hear the click, and they know they have you. And so the epigraph to each of these poems is one of her questions. And so this poem is called Sky, and the epigraph, which is one of her questions, is, "Why is the sky so tall and over everything? What you draw as a blue stripe high above a green stripe, white interrupted, the real sky starts at the tip of each blade of grass and goes up, up, as far as you can see. Our house stops at the roof, at the glitter black overlap of shingles where the sky presses down, bearing the weight of space, dark and sparkling, on its back. Think of sky not as blue, not as over, but as the invisible surround, a soft suit you wear close to the skin. When you walk, the soles of your feet take turns on the ground, but the rest of you is in the sky, enveloped in sky. As you move through it, you make a tunnel in the precise size and shape of your body."
Tremendous.
Thank you.
What is it about?
What is it about?
To your daughter, she probably would ask the same question.
What is it about?
So it's sort of a childlike question, but
yeah.
tell us what it's about.
I mean, we were driving to the library, and she was sitting in the back seat, and she asked, "Why is the sky so tall and over everything?"
And she was how old?
Three.
Three. Okay.
We were just, you know, driving downtown, and of course you see the, you know, the skyline, and it seems like the sky is very tall and over everything, And it made me think, I mean, obviously the poem is not the answer I gave her in the car. It's hard enough being the child of a poet without having your parent answer you with a sonnet in the car. But what it really caused me to do was meditate on the question, which is, what is the sky? How do we perceive it? You know, thinking about a child's drawing of the sky, which is often that blue stripe at the top, a green stripe at the bottom for the grass, and then there's just nothing in the middle. Right. Well, what is that? It's actually sky. You should really just be coloring the blue down to the green stripe at the bottom of the page. And just thinking about the way we move in the world. And I mean, it is a little bit about magic, I think.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 4 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a remarkable crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Selvary Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. And if you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is the author of 17 books and is also an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Maggie Smith, an award-winning poet whose most recent collection, Good Bones, was published with critical acclaim. She's on Twitter, at Maggie Smith Poet, MaggieSmithPoet. There's one of the things that sort of, the line at the end where you talk about it, it envelops you, it's close to you by the skin. There's a connectivity to all of this that at least speaks to me in the words that it's not, you know, these three strata. It's all one and the same.
Yep, and you're in it. You are actually moving through it.
So part of it is a connection to nature, to the mm-hmm. natural world.
Absolutely. We talk about nature all the time as if it is this other thing and not where we live.
Right.
You know, one of the questions I get a lot about this book is, what's with the birds? Why are there so many birds in the book? And it's, you know, it's the one kind of, it's the one piece of wilderness that no matter what you, where you live in the world, you're surrounded by birds.
Oh,
it doesn't matter
so true,
if you're
it?
In the city, the suburbs, the country. You know, we get deer and fox and we have lots of squirrels, so in the suburbs where I live. But regardless of where you are, you see birds all the time. Mm. And so that idea that nature isn't apart from where we live, it's actually our environment.
But that's an important message, you know, for our time, in time of climate change and of, I guess, still some lingering debate as to whether such a thing exists.
Yeah.
Ridiculous debate, but that's
Agreed.
Important.
Agreed.
So I want to get into the title poem.
Yeah.
Good Bones. And it begins, "Life is short, though I keep this from my children. Life is short, and I've shortened mine." And it goes on, and we're not going to have you read the whole thing, but tell us about that poem, which has become a viral sensation and is a very well-known poem now.
It's the strangest thing in the world to have the fastest poem I've ever written be the one that most people have read.
How long did it take to write?
20 minutes.
Really?
Really?
Oh, my God.
In a Starbucks. So that's,
really?
I mean, it sounds apocryphal, but it's actually true.
Okay, so walk us through that. You're ordering your...
No, I just, you know, every once, I just got a night off and didn't have the kids. And so I walked up to the Starbucks that's, you know, half a mile from my house and sat in a comfy chair. They've since rearranged, so I don't get to sit in the same place where I wrote the poem anymore. The nerve. And just put,
well, when you're at Hollywood Boulevard, they
yeah,
can put
right,
you in the star.
Precisely.
Yeah.
They're like, she's just a poet. And put earbuds in and sat down with a legal pad, which is how I write everything. Although I tend to write in bits and pieces. Like I'll get a little scrap of language and I'll write it down. And I may have to wait with that for a month or 6 months or a year before other scraps of language join it and it wants to be a poem. And this one, I think maybe because of the repetition was sort of like me revving the engine. I was just sort of getting into it, and then the momentum of that repetition carried me through to the very end of the poem. So I sat down and wrote it and then didn't think it was any good, because how good can a poem that you write in 20 minutes at a Starbucks be?
The toil, the struggle. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Let's be frank. You cannot trust that poem. But then when I went back to revise it, I only took out one word.
Just one word.
One word. The original version said, "I am trying to sell them on the world." And I took out the word, I took out the word "on," and just made it very direct. I'm trying to sell them the world, not sell them on it, actually sell it to them. And that was what led me to the realtor image, was the idea
but,
of actually
but
selling it.
There's a difference
it.
Between on and using and not using, which is, gets to, you know, the importance of every single word in
right.
a poem, as opposed to in a novel where you can get away with some excess verbiage.
Yeah.
The poem itself is, we're talking about Good Bones, is a sort of a reflection on the struggles of being a parent in a world that is horribly flawed.
Yes.
And how do you prepare your kids for the rawness of the world without sort of so warping them and jading them that they just want to say, well, I don't know, what's the point?
Right.
Right? So unpack that a little bit for us.
I mean, if you have any answers, I would love
well,
to hear.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, it's for me, it's the double bind of, I want to be honest with my kids and I don't want to lie to them. But on the other hand, I don't want them to hate the place I brought them to, right? Because I brought them here. So, I mean, there's another poem in this book that ends, "I'm desperate for you to love the world because I brought you here." I mean, I do feel in a way that it's my job to be honest with them about the sort of darkness, but also to show them the light. I'm not really doing them a service as a parent, as a sort of tour guide in this new place that I've brought them to, if I'm only showing them the bad or only showing them the good. I mean, I can't dwell in either place wholly either. You know, if I'm only focusing on the good, I might be, you know, turning a blind eye to things that need to be addressed. And if I get so bogged down, if I spend too much time on Twitter, if I watch too much, you know, CNN, I'll get so bogged down in what's wrong, I won't focus on the beauty.
But there's a beauty in this poem, because the good bones is sort of it's the realtor expression. Yeah, the house has some problems, but it's got good bones.
Yeah.
And so there's hope in this too.
I hope so. I mean, I don't see it as a depressing poem. I see it as, look, we have a lot of work to do, but we can do the work. It's fixable. That's, I think, the overall message. Although I've heard from many people that that's not what it's about. So, you know, when you send a piece of work into the world, it's, you know, not yours to control what other people think about it. And it feels sort of like public domain work to me at this point. So many people have sort of taken it and made it their own.
Well, I was Googling you to get ready for this episode, and I came across a film interpretation of this.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
It's a motion poems film. And so I guess it was the last season of Motion Poems. They match. It's a non-for-profit in Minneapolis, and they match poets with filmmakers. And so I actually had two poems, one from this book and one from my next book, that were selected by two different filmmakers to be made into short films.
It's like 13 minutes, and it sort of tells the story with your words.
Their interpretation. Yeah. So their visual interpretation of what they got from the poem. And, you know, you get a storyboard, basically, that shows you their sort of what they're going for. And that's really it. And so I got to see it when everyone else got to see it at the very end. And I absolutely cried. It was so meaningful to see what this genius filmmaker did and the performances. And there's a child in each of the films. Just amazing performances. I mean, so this poem has gotten to go places and do things that, you know, this poem's traveled places I'll never see, which I could be better, but I'm not. I think it's really exciting.
Well, tell us about some of those places. It was the title of an episode of a popular television show.
Yeah, it was on Madam Secretary. I did not get to go to Madam Secretary. It's probably all for the better. I got sent a script and I got to watch it on TV. But it's been translated into so many languages that I can't read or speak. And so there are people who are experiencing the poem in other languages, and probably the words good bones don't appear in the poem in other languages because it's an idiom.
Yeah.
So you can't, I actually worked with a Bengali translator personally to translate the poem into Bengali. And you can't translate good bones, literally. It doesn't make any sense. It would be something like positive skeleton,
right.
Which makes no sense. And so I think what it ended up being was something like strong foundation or solid structure that kind of gets across the idea. And so probably I would be surprised if any of the translations of good bones actually have the word good or bones in the poem.
So this is not an everyday occurrence in the world of poetry. Nor in the world of the larger world of stories, you know. How did this happen that it became viral and international and translated and on American TV? And what, I mean, there's something about the poem, obviously, that had a universal appeal. elaborate answer from Maggie, if we could.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was really a perfect storm of the poem. I mean, I wrote the poem in 2015, but it wasn't published until June of 2016.
Oh, and there was, go ahead.
Right, the week that the poem was published online, which is also critical. So it was published in an online journal called Waxwing. So the week that it was published online was the week of the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando.
Oh.
And the same week that Joe Cox, the member of parliament, was killed in Northern England.
Yeah.
And so the poem appeared online and went viral here because people were sharing it in the wake of what had happened in Orlando, and were sharing it in the UK in the wake of what had happened to Joe Cox, who was a mother of small kids.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it just sort of took off on both sides of the Atlantic because of the publication timing.
So when you wrote this, obviously you didn't know what was going to happen in Orlando or in the UK.
No.
As a poet, though, you know, how does that affect you that it then becomes associated with? Because I think it goes back to the hopefulness that's in it.
Yeah.
People in the midst of those tragedies were saying, but yeah. there's still something good here.
It's right. a really strange thing I can't quite describe, that when my social media mentions start going really wild, my instinct is never, great, people are sharing my work. My instinct is always first, oh no, what happened?
Oh.
Because it's become sort of a disaster barometer, this poem. And so I was giving a reading in New York City, and I came back and my Twitter was going crazy, and I thought, oh no, what happened? It was the Ariana Grande concert bombing in Manchester.
Oh, yeah.
And then the night before my publication date, I woke up on the pub date of Good Bones, the book, and my social media was going crazy. And I knew better than to think that that was because it was my publication day. It was because of the time zone lag. It was my book was published the morning after the Las Vegas shooting.
Oh, wow.
And so every time something like this happens, but this poem has a new life.
Yeah.
There's more to this than coincidence and timing. It's the essence of the poem. We've talked a bit about that. You know, the message that in the middle of these dark things that you've had to tell your children about, because that is the world you
yeah.
brought them into, there are also good things. And I think, you know, I'm sort of even getting chills even saying that. But that
yeah.
is really why that happened, I think, not simply because we live in an era of social media that certainly expedited, accelerated, whatever the word is.
It's
the content.
Do you ever, so we got about a minute and a half left here, do you ever consciously grapple though, with public issues in your work?
Yeah, I mean, the other poem that was made into a motion poem is called Small Shoes, and that one was inspired by the image of the Syrian refugee boy who'd washed up on the beach, who at the time was 3 years old and was the same age as my son, wearing a very similar outfit to something that my son would have worn.
Mm-hmm.
And so actually my next collection that I'm working on now is dealing more and more with these issues, especially as we're seeing family separation at the border. I mean, it's impossible to be a parent and a writer, I think, and not grapple with these issues on the page. I don't think it's my job. I don't necessarily think that I never want to come to the page and give the poem a job. I try not to come with some idea. I don't want to be,
proselytizing.
No.
Finger wagging or anything.
No, I don't think that poems need to do that, but I do think that there is a way to grapple on the page that helps people process and that maybe does connect us in ways that would be helpful.
Your work is absolutely beautiful. We didn't get to talk about nearly enough of it, so you're going to have to come back.
You've got to come back.
She's Maggie Smith. The collection is Good Bones. You want to check it out. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Storying the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org, where you can always catch previous episodes. He's Wayne, I'm Jim. We hope you'll join us again next time for more Storying the Public Square.